Moy. Led by pianist and composer O'Farrell, the Grammy-winning group brings their signature vibrant, spirited performance style and sounds steeped in Latin jazz traditions to the stage. Further information and tickets are available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're on. I'm Maria Hall. Good afternoon, friends. Welcome to the Lawyers Guild Show. Sorry about those little technical snafus, but we are on and ready to go. My co-host Jim Lafferty has the day off today, so that's probably what jinxed us with little snafu. But we're so fortunate that Richard Becker will be joining me this hour to talk about two critical topics. In our first segment, we'll talk about tactics being used to suppress voices critical of the Trump administration, reminiscent of those old McCarthy days. Then in our second half hour, we'll look into the 20-point plan that Trump just announced, supposedly to achieve a ceasefire and end to Israel's war on Gaza. And there's a lot to unpack there. But first, I do want to remind everyone it's KPFK's fund drive time, and neither Jim nor myself are paid to be here to put together these shows for you. It's a labor of love for us. We are happy to do it. So we just need to fundraise because there are so many other expenses like equipment, lights, the fabulous engineers and staff. So we do need to pull together to pay for it. So just jump on kpfk.org to make your pledge. And our goal is to raise this hour $1,000. So please help me out. Every single dollar counts. And it just takes a lot of us to give a little bit. So while you go to kpfk.org to donate, start introducing our first topic, which was inspired by an article last Sunday in the LA Times entitled Echoes of Red Scare in Trump Memo. The memo, of course, was the Trump memo focusing federal law enforcement on disrupting so-called domestic terrorism in the wake of the shooting of Charlie Kirk. And then during the signing of the memo at the White House ceremony, quote, the president and his top advisors repeatedly hinted at a much broader campaign of suppression against the American left. Now, of course, the American left is never defined, so it leaves us wondering exactly who he means. And White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller went so far as to claim this is part of an organized campaign of radical left terrorism. And at the signing ceremony, Trump mentioned so-called riots by Black Lives Matter and an organization called Antifa. So are we experiencing a new McCarthyism, a new red scare directed at a much broader and more amorphous definition of the left than during the anti-communist witch hunts of the 50s and 60s and the lavender anti-gay scare of the Cold War and beyond? Well, to help us answer these and other questions, we're so fortunate to have as our guest today Richard Becker. Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of the Act Now to Stop War and End Racism Coalition, or ANSWR. He's also the author of a highly praised book, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire, published in 2013 with an edited edition.
Thank you.
He's also the author of the book entitled The Myth of Democracy and the Rule of the Banks, and also a national leader in the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Richard Becker, welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show.
Thanks very much, Maria. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, to start us off with some facts, do statistics show that most of the political violence in the United States in recent years comes from people or groups aligned with the left politically or the right?
Well, a recent study, I believe it was by Pew, over the last several years showed that more than 60% of all acts of political violence were by the right wing, people who identified as being right wing or were identified. And from the left, and I think this is even high, it's 22%. So what Trump is putting forward, and Bondi and Patel and this whole crew is completely swelled. I mean, it's one of the many, many lies that they're trying to foist on the people.
Mm-hmm. Well, supporters of the president claim that what Trump is doing is no different than what Democratic President Biden did when he was in office. How true is that?
you know, what the Biden administration did and didn't do really paved the way for a second Trump term. I mean, when you really look at it, when you really look at what shape Trump was in after January 6th of 2020, the January 6th, what happened on January 6th at the Capitol, the storming of the Capitol, and his clear responsibility for that, he was in a really bad shape politically. But instead of him being, taken out of the political game altogether, it was the way that the Democrats pursued that, and then the way that they pursued their own campaign in 2024 really paved the way. But having said that, we have to recognize that there is a difference here, that the Trump administration, what Trump's doing and the people around Trump, Stephen Miller, Russell Vought, I think are two key ones, Russell Vought being the author of Project 2025, and Miller being the top advisor and a really vicious right-wing character. What they're trying to do, along with Trump, is they're trying to reorganize the government. They're trying to have a new form of governance in the United States, mm-hmm. one that diminishes the rights that people have fought for and won over the last 100 years, in order to open the way for the unlimited exploitation of labor and resources by the billionaires, the real ruling class of the United States, who don't see any reason why they have to keep having these rights or social programs, which are also being slashed. So they've unleashed a reign of terror against part of the population, the immigrant population in particular. But their intention is to bring about a new form of governance in favor of the rich and to the great disadvantage of the masses of working class people, poor people, oppressed communities, women, LGBTQ people. That's who they're going after. They're going after our rights.
Mm-hmm. And you've been warning of this for decades, I think. But I would imagine that saying "I told you so" is not really it's not making you feel much better, is it?
No. I mean, what's necessary now is we don't want to, we need to have a united front against this. That's what we need. That's the only thing that's going to stop it, is a really broad and strong and determined united front. And I think that it's in formation.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Well, that's why we love to be here on KPFK, our host station, so that we can talk to you and guests like you. So our next question, Douglas Charles is a history professor at Penn State. He authored a book called Hoover's War on Gays, Exposing the FBI's quote-unquote sex deviance program. He said the Trump memo strongly parallels past efforts at political repression. For example, the memo claims that, quote, extremism on migration, race and gender, and anti-Americanism, anti-capitalism, and anti-Christianity are the cause of violence in our country. So the historian asked, what is this, McCarthyism redux? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question. It's an important question for us to understand where we're at. And, there's people are referring to this as possibly the third Red Scare. And the first one was in the immediate period after World War I, beginning really in 1918 and lasting into the early 1920s. And it was a big attack by the Attorney General's office on anarchists, communists, socialists, any progressive people. It was called the Palmer Raids because Palmer was the Attorney General of the United States at that time. And so there was a new movement in the world because of the Russian Revolution, and it was inspiring activists and working people all over the world. And frightened the ruling classes of the capitalist countries, particularly in Europe and the United States, and some others as well, but particularly there. So that was that. The Palmer Raids were Red Scare number one. Red Scare number two comes after World War II, and really begins in 1947 with purges of communists who had played a huge role in organizing the mass unions of the 1930s and 40s in auto and rubber and all kinds of mass industries, and the steel workers union. So at that time, the Communist Party was quite strong coming out of World War II. And the purge of the unions was followed by McCarthyism, McCarthy really coming on the scene in 1950. And the idea was, or their idea was to smash the Communist Party as part of the drive, a global drive, when the U.S. was now moving into to being the central leading power in the world. And they looked at Washington, looked at the communist movements and other progressive movements as allies of their enemy in the world, which was the socialist camp, which at that time, by the early 1950s, comprised a third of the population of the world lived in a socialist country.
Wow.
So we had that, and so and now this time around, we believe that there's a surging movement, a growing movement. We've seen it in the Black Lives Movement. I mean, we can go back to Occupy Wall Street. There have been a series of movements that have led to the reemergence of a young movement, and with many, many hundreds of thousands, millions of people in it. You see them at the, you see people, not just young people, old people, older people too, but this, they want to crush this movement. They want to smash this movement because they see them, this movement as standing in the way of the unfettered exploitation, as I said, of labor and resources inside the country. So that's what's going on, I think, and it's so it's the third Red Scare, but it's they've each had their own characteristics.
Mm-hmm. It is so interesting to look at it in that light, because as we're moving through it, it feels like, how do you analyze it when you're in the midst of it? That's how I've been, you know, trying to grapple with it. And just as an aside, when, you know, people in the Trump administration call groups or people socialists or leftists or communists, do you think they actually have a definition? Because when they call people like Adam Schiff or like other people who I consider mainstream, you know, middle of the road Democrats, do you think they actually have an understanding? Because I know you know what a socialist or what socialism would actually mean. I mean, do you think they even know, or do they care?
I think what they are doing is taking on and attacking everyone. Basically, everyone is, as the saying goes, to the left of Mussolini, because they want to knock out anybody and any organizations, unions, community organizations, nonprofit groups, political organizations, all kinds of organizations that will fight against what they want to do, will fight against their program, which is the billionaire program. And so even these very, I mean, you can't call Adam Schiff a leftist. I'm sorry. And you all in
exactly.
L.A. know that better than anybody. I mean, he's a big supporter of Israel. But it shows how wide-ranging the aspiration is here. It's to really smash anyone who might get in their way. But I think a lot of people, having said that, I think a lot of people are getting in the way. People have been fighting all over the country against the attacks on immigrants, or against the police brutality that's going on, the terrible suffering that's taking place in Gaza, and incredible what's happening there. And people are coming out. People are not intimidated. People are fighting back, and are going to fight back even harder.
I've been surprised. I mean, I guess I'm pleasantly surprised in the legal profession when we first saw several big law firms kind of caving to threats by the Trump administration. But now I've seen also within, you know, just mainstream, you know, the American Bar Association and other big law firms really pushing back and, you know, fighting for the First Amendment and the freedom to represent people who they want to represent. So
that's very important.
Oh, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I just want to say that's so important that everywhere where people are going to stand up to what Trump is trying to do right now is really, really critical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have heard people say, oh, but a lawsuit's not going to fix it. But it's definitely a piece of the puzzle.
Right.
Well, I wanted to ask about, you know, especially for Black Lives Matter, we do have a large, you know, Los Angeles movement, different groups, of course, but there has been a feeling like, especially anyone affiliated with Black Lives Matter now has a target on their back because of this new memo from Trump. How do you feel about that? Do you think they really are going after individuals, or are they just blanket targeting groups, or what are your thoughts?
Well, I think that they're going after individuals, I think, to some extent, although the individuals who have mainly been gone after have been immigrants, people who are undocumented or don't have full citizenship. That's who's really being targeted so far. That is not to say that the intention is not to target more. We definitely know it's true. They're planning to, the Black Lives Matter movement, other movements against police brutality, the unions are being targeted. All kinds of people, all kinds of organizations are being targeted. The attack on trans people, the attack going on. And it's this group that's really running the show in Washington, they'd like to get rid of marriage equality. They'd like to get rid of women's rights, and they say so. I don't think they can do it, but hey, listen to them. They're talking that way. So there's a lot of targeting that's going on, I think, particularly in the Black Lives Matter movement has been a real target and is very, very much hated by the Trump administration and the people around it, who are also, you know, vicious racists themselves. I mean, this is a really racist crew that wants to get rid of everything, you know, diversity they view as their enemy. And you heard, people heard Hegseth yesterday, that now called the Secretary of War. I don't think they formally changed the name yet, but his speech to the admirals and generals, of whom there were 800, was get rid of all diversity. And in fact, really what he meant was get rid of women and get rid of black people and other people of color out of the leadership, out of the people who are in the room, who are from those communities. They have a very ambitious agenda of rolling back everything, as I said before, everything that's been won over the last 100 years.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you have, you know, an anti-war background. So it is interesting, too, to see how they want to kick people out of the military, but yet you probably know the military is having a really hard time meeting their targets of recruits as well. So there's this strange irony. I don't know. Do you have any more insight on that? I mean, does it really attract people to join, you know, with...
Well, I think the people who it will attract are, you know, are probably more right wing. Although a lot of people join the military, it's still true. They reduce the recruiting targets so that they could meet them. But there still are a lot of people who come from military families, where a lot of people have traditionally served in the military. And also just, you know, they're out recruiting in the high schools, and you know, we have an activist here who went in when he was 17 into the served 4 years in the Marines. He ended up hating it, but he went in because, you know, he didn't see what other possibilities in life were for him, and their pay is much better. The benefits are much better. You can get all kinds of things. So they're going to continue to attract some people, but it's definitely it's on the decline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it'll be interesting kicking out, I think, 6,000 or 7,000 transgender people, and yeah. To be able to keep the standing army and at the same time kicking people out. And we'll have you on that subject in a few months. We'll see what happens. So on this segment, I do want to leave time for our next segment as well on Gaza. So I did want to leave listeners with some action items. You know, what are the most effective ways that individuals who might hold beliefs that are critical of this administration and want to do something about it, is there a way that they can respond to this new McCarthyism? What lessons have we learned from the past? And what can people do rather than just self-censor and kind of cave into the fear?
Yeah, caving into the fear is not gonna work. It's not gonna save us. You know, I think first of all, people should organize, should be active wherever they are, and in whatever ways they can do. I just came back from Western New York State. I work with people there. It's a agricultural area. Voted for Trump. The largest cheese factory in the United States is in a small town called Franklinville. And it had a huge spill and killed tens of thousands of fish. And the people in that area, a lot of whom voted for Trump, they're dependent on hunting and fishing. And there's a lot of die-off of animals and fish. And so people are there protesting. That's a small example, but these kinds of things, actually, we don't see them because mainstream media doesn't make a point of showing us how much is happening all over the country. But on October 18th, there will be mass demonstrations again by many different organizations against the Trump program. I don't know what the exact title is going to be, but it's very important for people to participate in these demonstrations to support our neighbors who are undocumented or who have limited papers, who have people who are being subject to Roundup, brutality, deportations, wherever we can to go out this weekend. I know there will be protests calling for an end to the genocide, the horrific conditions inside of Gaza. So there are many, many ways that people can get involved. And if they want to know more, they can go to answercoalition.org. And it's all one big word, answercoalition.org.
Mm-hmm. Well, great. Thank you, Richard Becker. We're going to take a very short station ID break, and then we'll be back to talk more about Gaza.
All right, let's see what happens. Hey, what's up? It's Christian James Hand. I'm just a music fan, and I'm sitting in the KPFK studios, and I'm wondering if why you're listening to KPFK right now, and you haven't called 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Why, if you're listening, are you not supporting? Radio is the last live medium in the universe. If you don't support this, it goes away. And why would you listen to radio promoted by Coca-Cola, etc., etc., when you could be listening to people-powered radio by people that care about what they're doing, have a passion for the music, have a passion for the subject matter? It's not made for the general public. It's made for people that care. So if you care, then you got to care about what you care about. And if you care about what you care about, then you have no choice but to pick up the phone and support people-powered radio. Because the other solution is computer-powered radio. And computer-powered radio is not radio.
Your call is important to us. Please press hash to continue. Your call is important to us. Your call is important to us.
That's computers.
That's computers.
That's computers. This is real people making real radio about things that they really care about. And I care about that. And if you do too, simple. 818-985-5735. Why wouldn't you do it? You wouldn't do it if you were a... All right. Does that work?
I think I only have your number.
All right, we are back. Welcome back to the Lawyers Guild Show. I'm Maria Hall, your co-host. Jim Lafferty, my co-host, is taking the day off today, but I'm so lucky to be spending the hour with Richard Becker. We were talking about, you know, is this the third Red Scare, the McCarthyism coming home to roost back in our generation? So now we're going to totally switch, well, not totally, but we're going to switch topics now. To the Middle East, this month marks the second anniversary of this most recent Israeli war on Palestine, and the latest casualties published by the Palestinian Ministry of Health are just astounding, over 66,000 fatalities in Gaza, over 1,000 lives lost in the West Bank, as well as 178,000 injuries in the region. Just due to the relentless assaults that we've been seeing by Israel since October 2023. The world is watching, and as of last weekend, at least 157 countries now publicly recognize a Palestinian state, including United Kingdom, France, Canada, and Australia. Of course, the United States is not on that list, as it's arguably Israel's strongest supporter, especially since Trump got reelected. So, as international criticism of Israel continues to grow, Trump announced on Monday a new proposal, a 20-point plan, he calls it, for achieving a ceasefire. Of course, the plan would be contingent on agreement and cooperation by all sides, including Hamas. So to talk us through all of this, again, I'm so fortunate to have with us Richard Becker to talk through these issues. And if you missed the start of the show, I just want to remind you that Mr. Becker is the Western Regional Coordinator of ANSWER, and he's also the author of the highly praised book, Palestine, Israel, and the U.S. Empire. So thanks again, Richard, for being on with me both segments today.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Okay, so let's get into this a little bit. Oh, and I should remind people, please give your pledge. I'm not dwelling on it because I want to get through these questions with Richard, but please do give to KPFK. It's so important. KPFK.org, there's really nice thank you gifts that you can choose from on there. So please do that while we're talking. Multitask. Okay, so first question, why do you think Trump offered this proposal for a ceasefire at this particular moment in time?
Well, Trump has his own personal ambition, which is to win the Nobel Peace Prize. He's going for that. Uh-huh. But more importantly than that is that we're at a very critical moment in the struggle, and it's what he's come up with is not really a proposal that is negotiated between the sides in the conflict. It's just an imposition. It's just he is meeting with Netanyahu, and they're attempting to put into place an agreement, but an agreement without any agreement on the side of Hamas or the Palestinian other Palestinian resistance organizations, of which there are several. So he's trying to do this and bring a conclusion to the struggle, which is, as you said, 157 countries have now recognized Palestine, the state of Palestine. The support for the Palestinians is growing all over the world, and Trump would like to stop it because it is a problem for the U.S. empire, and you know, which is all over the world as well. So they're doing that at this point, but I think the most important thing to see about it at this point is that the Palestinians were not at the table. They had nothing to do with the drafting of this. They're in a very, very difficult position, an extremely, an indescribably difficult condition because of the death toll that you mentioned. The death toll may be much higher than what we mm-hmm. see. And the suffering of the people, the famine, the disease, all of that is, and it's been going on now for 2 years. And so mm-hmm. With those conditions, the Palestinians are put in a very, very difficult situation. And, you know, they weren't part of the negotiation. There was no negotiation with them. But now they're confronted with the promise by Israel that if the agreement isn't reached, that there'll be an all-out assault and Trump has said he would support that.
Mm-hmm. So who are the stakeholders that would be involved in the negotiations, and who gave their two cents, you know, besides the U.S. and Netanyahu, obviously?
Well, the stakeholders, in addition to the U.S. and Israel, are several of the Arab governments, which are reactionary governments. The Palestinians mm-hmm. have, for a long time, considered the many of the Arab governments, most of them, to be really aligned with imperialism and friendly to Israel, despite the whatever they may say, you know, in public. So they're involved. Other Muslim countries, predominantly Muslim countries, are involved and have expressed their support for the proposal. So this makes it much more difficult, a much more, even more difficult situation for the Palestinians. But as I said, and it's most important to understand, they have not been included. And, you know, we should, in 1917, what really propelled the Zionist project, which became the State of Israel, forward, was something called the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration came from the British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, and it promised to the Zionists, those who were trying to organize for a state, that the British would look with support on the establishment of a national home in Palestine. Well, Britain didn't control Palestine. They took it over a year later, but even if they had, it was a matter of their promising to an oppressed people from a poor part of the colonized part of the world territory that they have no right to be promising. So that happened. That happened, and it's important because it showed that from the very beginning, the Zionist project, once it got the support of the British, was a Western colonial project. What we're seeing today is a Western colonial negotiation that has gone on. And again, just as it was in 1917, the Palestinian people have been left out of the picture altogether.
Mm-hmm. So I know the 20-point plan, it does talk about release of hostages, exchange of some prisoners, I think, as well as de-escalating the violence, supposedly. So let's start with the release of hostages. What does it say about that and the exchange of prisoners?
It says there's believed to be 20 hostages who are alive and 28 who have died. Most of them have been killed by the bombing, if not all. And there's then on the other side, and they're never called hostages, but they are hostages, are more than 10,000 Palestinians inside Israeli prisons, all of them held illegally under international law. And the vast majority of them are there only for being political activists in their communities, in Palestinian communities. The promise is that 250 of those who have life sentences would be released, and around 1,200 of those who were arrested in Gaza over the last 2 years. They have been subjected, and this is almost never discussed in the mainstream media here, they have been subjected to torture, to systematic torture and abuse. The head of the prison system is a man named Itamar Ben-Gvir, who's the most extreme right-wing member of Netanyahu's cabinet, and is who himself is a fascist. And so the Israeli organization called B'Tselem, which is Israeli human rights organization, has published a paper, and people can find it online. Anyone can find it. It's called Welcome to Hell, and it's about what the conditions have been inside the Israeli prisons over the last 2 years, and it is truly hell.
Mm. Well, as far as, you know, de-escalating the violence there, so this 20-point plan, it, you know, nominally requires Israeli forces to withdraw, but very gradually, and I don't know what mechanism there would be to enforce it, but what does the, at least in the plan, what does it say about that withdrawal process, and how long could it take if the plan were somehow accepted by Hamas?
Well, again, it's, they are in a very, very difficult position right now, Hamas and the other resistance organizations. And what to do? I mean, there's been so much suffering by the population. And there's no counting that the Israelis will stick to any agreement that they make. You know, I have seen that Trump's son-in-law has and his top advisor on Palestine. I have both been in the Middle East recently, and they're talking about how they could recreate Gaza, and how it's just prime real estate. This is how they talk about people's country. It's prime real estate for waterfront development because it's right on the sea and so forth. So you have that that's going on, and the so. Will any territory come back to the Palestinians? I don't think that there's any intention of that. I don't think the Palestinians have any intention of giving up their national aspirations as a people, as a whole. But, you know, we don't know, but we certainly can't count on the idea that, the outcome that there would be some real justice for the Palestinians due to this agreement, and that's the agreement as a whole. The agreement is not, and again, I have to stress this: it's not really an agreement at all. It's an ultimatum. The ultimatum is being made to the Palestinians. You didn't have any part in negotiating this. We don't even, you know, there was an agreement that Hamas with a lot of concessions made in August, and the Israelis responded to that agreement by launching massive bombing. So that agreement went away at that time. So this time around, they weren't even talked to. They were not even negotiated with. They're just being confronted and presented with an ultimatum that says, either you accept this, or Israel's going to carry all out bombing and its armor and supplier. The Trump administration is going to support them in doing so.
So is it fair to say that it would be requiring that Hamas basically surrender? And if so, what is the interplay between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority? Are they separately supposed to be talking to the Americans on this proposal, or how does that work?
Well, what they're saying, and quite openly, quite blatantly, is that the authority that existed, that has existed in Gaza, which was led by the Hamas party, or the body in the West Bank based in Ramallah, which is the Fatah party and the Palestinian Authority, that neither one of them will have any part in the governance of Gaza. They very, very straightforwardly say this. So it's really, and the other person whose name is being floated around is Tony Blair, the former British Prime Minister who took Britain into the Iraq War and who, you know, Britain has, I mentioned the Balfour Declaration, but Britain has this horrific history of colonialism in the Middle East and around the world, but in the Middle East in particular. So the idea that Blair could become kind of the new leader of some formation in Gaza, it's kind of like when they brought a guy in, back in 2003 when the U.S. conquered Iraq. They brought this guy who had been a low-level diplomat, and he was also the head of the Arabian Horses Association. And they made him the dictator of Iraq, and he was served in that position for a year. So they've had some experience in doing this, And that's what the other thing is, though, it might not be Blair. It might be Trump, because in the proposal is that Trump would be the president of something called the Board of Peace that would oversee.
I was going to ask you about that. Sounds so nice. I mean, there's a lot of language in here that sounds great until you look at the fine print. For example, they have, you know, they want to present a quote-unquote credible pathway to Palestinian self-determination and statehood, and then creating this so-called Board of Peace. And you'd mentioned before about the real estate, and Trump had mentioned turning Gaza into the quote-unquote Riviera of the Middle East. But then even as of last Sunday, Netanyahu said it will not happen, meaning no Palestinian state. So what are those mixed messages? How serious is this proposal? Is it offered in good faith, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's not offered in good faith. I think that's very clear that it's not. And, you know, we should view the mention of the Palestinian right of self-determination as nothing but a fig leaf. Because if they were concerned about the Palestinians' right to self-determination, why would they have excluded them from any negotiations that brought about this current talk? They did. The Palestinian representatives were in talks before, and 3 weeks ago, they were in Qatar in the Gulf, and while the negotiations were going on, Israel bombed the building they thought that the Palestinian negotiators were in. I mean, that could tell you everything, really, that you need to know about how serious they are in terms of any kind of negotiated outcome that would provide the slightest bit of self-determination or justice for the Palestinians. It's not there. They feel what Trump and Netanyahu and Trump's advisors feel is that they have the Palestinians in a position that they can't continue. And that may not be what happens, though. I think that there's tremendous opposition from across the spectrum of the Palestinians to accepting this agreement. The issue is really one that's, you know, on one side is this agreement, and on the other side is the promise of massive bombing and deployment of Israeli forces into Gaza and probably into the West Bank as well. Mm-hmm. One thing I wanted to add is that, you know, the other day, I think it was last Monday or 2 days ago, Trump said in a press conference, "No, I told Israel you can't annex the West Bank," and they didn't. And so they were talking about announcing it. So what does that show us? It shows us that for everything that's been going on, everything else that's going on, the Trump administration are the partners in all of it. Israel can't really take the big steps without getting the okay from the United States. And so I think it's a bitter, bitter lesson, but it's a lesson that should be learned for all the people who, you know, over the years thought that Israel was somehow controlling the U.S. And no, that's not why the support has been there. The support has been there because Israel is a vital part of the U.S. empire. It's a projection of U.S. military power in a key strategic region of the world. That's why it gets the money. And it's different than any other country in the world. Even the other allies of the U.S., like Egypt or Saudi Arabia or Jordan or others, it's different because it's an implantation. It's a colony. It's a colonial state that has always been at odds with the surrounding population. And in that way, it makes it more valuable to the U.S. because it really can't be part of the region. It can only be an enemy of the region.
Well, I think I know the answer to this one. We've been seeing the international field play out. Does international law provide any remedies here? And what else can the world do? But then also, as you mentioned, here in the U.S., if the U.S. does have this much power in Israel, what can people even here do to have their voice heard?
Well, there's a movement in the United States. You know, at the end of August, there was the second People's Conference for Palestine in Detroit. Mm-hmm. And I went to both of them. There was one a year earlier. And the first one was about 3,000 people showed up. The second one, 4,500 people showed up. And it really shows that there's really a movement that has developed in the U.S. in solidarity with the Palestinians and against what the U.S. is doing. And that's very, very important. Just because the U.S. role is so critical, our responsibility for action is you know, all the more important. And so we have to continue. Right now, you know, there'll be demonstrations again this weekend, October 4th and Saturday. I saw that the flotilla was stopped a couple hours ago and boarded and was being seized. But nevertheless, that with whatever happens with it, it's an expression of, because so many different countries are represented in it, it's an expression of global support for the Palestinians. So there will be more that's going on. It's going to continue. And it's particularly important that people inside the United States take action.
Mm-hmm. And what about Congress people, or who's kind of leading the fight? Are there particular people that listeners can reach out to?
Well, there are a number of people in Congress now who are calling for an arms embargo and who are calling what's happening their genocide, which has not really taken place. That hasn't really happened before. I think that we've seen, you know, some of the Congress people, I don't know if there's any from the Los Angeles area, or I don't know. I haven't seen anybody do a lot in California in regard to the issue. There are others like Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, who's Palestinian. And there's others. I mean, a number of them, Bernie has called for an arms, you know, stopping the arms shipments and so forth. And so have a number of other Congress. The popular mood in the United States has shifted very definitively. It's shifted in a big way. It hasn't manifested itself yet in an end to any real big change in U.S. policy, but it has. There's definitely a huge shift that's taken place. I was in Geneva, New York, a couple of weeks ago. I was out at a thing where people, and it's a small city in a mainly rural area of upstate New York, and the people there, every Tuesday, they do something, and they go out on the street with signs and banners, and, you know, people honk at them. It was amazing how many people, and especially so many people who were driving pickup trucks and other, you know, equipment, who were like waving and, you know, and supporting it, and very few people who were really opposing it. So I thought was a marker of a change that's happening.
Yeah, really. And we are out of time, unfortunately. And I didn't do my all the pledging that I meant to do, but it was so interesting to talk to you and really inspiring that you're showing us the bigger picture and how we can play a role in making history and really trying to push our government to do the right thing. Thank you so much, Richard Becker, Western Regional Coordinator of ANSWER.
Give and money to KPFK.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. Yes, I appreciate that.
Make a donation. You're not going to hear this kind of thing in any of the mainstream media. So give money to KPFK.
That is so true. And I'm going on to make my pledge right now, since we're done. And thank you, Richard. And we will have you on again very soon, because there's so much happening so fast right now. So we really appreciate you.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Sure.
Okay. Thanks, listeners. That's our show for today. Thanks, Board Op. Sorry for all the technical difficulties, but we got it through. So please do give kpfk.org. There's really nice thank you gifts to go on and just check it out. And please leave a little note that it was for the Lawyers Guild show, too. We get brownie points, and I like to know that people are listening and that you appreciate us. So signing off until next week.
Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's an all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Joy Guidry on October 4th at the Nimoy. Guidry performs excerpts from her new album, Five Prayers. A celebrated voice in experimental and avant-garde music spaces, Guidry pairs the bassoon with low-rumbling synths, warm electronic sounds, and poetry that reflects the artist's lived experience as a Black trans woman from the South. Further information and tickets available at cap.ucla.edu. And KP.